in South Bend, Indiana, where she teaches in the MFA program at the University of Notre Dame with specialties in fiction writing, Latin American and Iberian literature, and literature and translation. Azarine Vandervliet Alumi is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her much-anticipated new novel out from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt entitled Call Me Zebra, a book that Kirkus in its starred review calls a bombastic homage to the metacriticism of Borges, the romantic absurdity of Cervantes, and the punk rock autofictions of Kathy Acker. This is a brilliant, demented, and bizarro book that demands and rewards all the attention a reader might dare to give it. The Los Angeles Review of Books says, Vandervliet Alumi captures the shattered identity of the refugee and the immigrant, the way that literature becomes a lifeline in exile, a movable home, a network of dissent, a genealogy beyond national borders. And the Wall Street Journal says, hearken ye fellow misfits, migrants, outcasts, squint-eyed bibliophiles, library haunters, and bookstall stalkers, here is a novel for you. Welcome to Between the Covers, Azarine Vandervliet Alumi.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd love to start our conversation with a little bit of world building together. For those who haven't yet read Call Me Zebra, both the circumstances of Zebra's life and this enchanting, labyrinthine philosophy that sort of emerges from the circumstance that she inherits. So let's start with the circumstance of Bibi Abbas Abbas Husseini, who eventually becomes called Zebra. Tell us about her family and family lineage she has been born into.
Yeah, so Bibi has, she was born in Iran, and during the Iran-Iraq War, she and her father and mother escape to the north near the Caspian, where the family has this really sort of eccentric home that they refer to as the Oasis of Books or the Censorship Recovery Center. And it's a space that the family, who's, you know, come from a long lineage of autodidacts, anarchists and atheists, have been retreating to during times of censorship or political oppression. And from there, they set off on foot to Turkey and then eventually to Barcelona and New York City. And we then encounter Zebra. She renames herself Zebra when her father passes away. And that's when we pick up the story, and she's decided to retrace the path of their exile after his death.
And one of the things that's interesting about the patrilineal lineage for Zebra is, even before they're in exile, there's a sense of there being a borderlessness to their appetites in terms of literature.
That's right. Her father is a big fan of Nietzsche, and at the same time really does believe that literature is the only nation without boundaries, with no checkpoints, no caste system. And so they read everything, and he reads to her from the moment she's born. So he'll read medieval Japanese literature to her, and then he'll read Dante and all the big philosophers. And he sort of builds this constellation of sentences in her mind. And she then refers to literature as a kind of superhighway of sentences that are interconnected. So it's a very transnational project at all times. And that's the way that she comes to see it.
Well, in the first chapter, Zebra, she presents the worldview of her father and her father's fathers, mm-hmm. That's been passed down to her. This world, as you described, of the mind and of books and a history of thought. And when she is in New York in the very beginning of, not too far into the novel, she loses her dad. And thus she's the only person left living in this constructed universe. Mm-hmm. And so, as you mentioned, she tries to retrace and reverse the history of exile of the family and calls it the Grand Tour of Exile, and is moving from the new world to the old world. And her father had said to her that memorization is our only recourse against loss. It sort of feels like this geographical retracing of their flight becomes an unexpected way to memorize. So I want to, if you could talk a little bit about, obviously in the most literal sense, he's talking about memorizing texts, but in a way it also feels like Zebra is doing this reverse exile as a form of memorization.
Absolutely. I think that's what Zebra discovers when she goes on this journey. Her intention is to go back and read all of the books in situ, right? So the books that her father would have read while they were in Barcelona, she wants to reread them in Barcelona as a way of trying to understand what could have been going through his mind. I neglected to mention that her mother dies while they're traveling on foot from Iran to Turkey, and part of Zebra's buried grief has to do with that unacknowledged loss or that sort of trauma early on. And the father's death then sort of solidifies the sense of loss that she has, and she begins to go on these walks that she calls these literary pilgrimages of fragmentation or burying excavated or excavating buried selves. And in the process, she realizes that so many of our memories are actually embedded in space, and that history leaves a trace in our bodies, in our architecture, in our art, and that literature, she sort of starts to inhabit that space where there's a deep intersection between literature and landscape, or literature and architecture. And she realizes that she's always living in a representation of the world in art rather than within the world itself. But she even questions whether or not one can live in the world unmediated, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the big philosophy of the matrix of literature starts really on these long walks that she goes on while she's reading.
Well, there are two maxims that Zebra inherits that I'd like to discuss sort of next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
One, that there's no such thing as reading, only rereading.
Right.
And the other, that memorization is a way to resist colonization. So if we think of Zebra's retracing of her family's flight as a form of memorization, as a recourse against loss, and also maybe a rereading of her own life.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could speak to the ways memorization of text or of place is an anti-colonial act.
Yeah, I mean, in her case in particular, so much about who she is, her body, and her sort of story has been narrativized for her, right? Whether that be in the immigrant experience that she has in the United States or in Spain, but then also the ways in which people's narratives or stories or identities are repressed even within their own homelands, right? So early on in Iran, the father is this sort of very committed intellectual and understands that the Iranian revolution is going to be hijacked, and refuses to kind of participate in the uprisings just because of his untrusting nature, but also because of his deep commitment to having memorized all of these texts through time. He understands that history is going to come back to settle its old scores at mm-hmm. any moment. And I think that for Zebra, the memorization of the texts is a reminder that you're never safe, that history is always going to pick a new victim, and also a way of being able to recreate that history so that people's stories aren't forgotten. So it's sort of a project of oral history, but through memorization. And it's also a relationship that I think a lot of people in exile have to memory in general, right? You preserve the memory by retelling it over and over and over again. And there's great risk in forgetting the story. Mm. There is a further risk of erasure in that forgetting that she's very aware of. Mm. Yeah.
You've said before that you were thinking a lot about the relationship between literature and landscape,
yeah.
and of what it would be to abandon the so-called new world and return to live in the old in order to sink into what you call the architecture of deep time.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, your current life going between Italy and Indiana various iterations and reiterations of this question, I'm imagining. But can you talk to us about this twinning of the old world with deep time and what that means?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it means something different to me than it does to the narrator of Call Me Zebra. I think that what I knew but then realized fully in writing this book is the dissociation that we feel or see in the new world. This kind of, and we see this especially now with the rise of racist politics, right? This feeling that the new world is isolated and not connected to anything that came before, or that people who arrived here long ago should have suspended their memories of that journey in order to fully lay claim to this land, right? And there are narratives of ownership that I think are deeply problematic and connected to a kind of suppression of those memories of being outcasts or migrants and landing here and then essentially occupying, right, the land. So that dissociative nature, I think, we see return in these very violent ways in our culture. I mean, we're seeing it now, and it's always been present. But I think it's a kind of deep, unacknowledged grief. And the landscape, I suppose, in the South, it's somewhat different. But I've never lived in the South. I've lived on the coasts, and the sort of, especially on the West Coast, the newness of the landscape and the architecture supports a kind of mental condition of forgetting, right? Mm-hmm. Because nothing in the environment is necessarily cueing us or triggering us to constantly have to participate in a culture of memory. In the old world, right, you're surrounded by architecture and history, and you can see all the stratified layers. So, for example, in Italy, you can sort of see exactly where the World War II bombings occurred, and there will be historic buildings flush against sort of restored buildings from the aftermath of the Second World War. And that kind of texture or overlapping is a palimpsest, right, that really fascinates me and I think is a sort of natural cultural memory that people participate in. Mm. Yeah.
Before we talk more about literature and its intersection with the landscape, I just wanted to touch briefly on something that I came across about your own life growing up.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe is the flip side of or the dark side of memorization. And I think of, for Zebra, this movable home, this way mm-hmm. to this anti-colonial act that sort of preserves identity as she moves from place to place is this act of memorization. But when you were a sixth grader and mm-hmm. the Ayatollah came back from his own exile, there was a different sort of memorization that you had to do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. I was a sixth grader, you're right, when this incident occurred, but the Ayatollah had already come back quite some time ago. So I was, there in the early 90s. And in class, we were asked to copy the story of Ayatollah's arrival to Iran from France and this heroic journey and salvation narrative about five times. We had to copy this story into our notebooks. And we had never been asked to do something like that before. Copying, actually, and dictation was something that we had to do regularly as a way of making sure we were learning to spell correctly, et cetera. And I think it's a vintage technology that people don't use in the classroom anymore. But when that happened, when we were asked to sort of copy his story and his journey, I just protested in class and said that I thought it was a form of brainwashing and that I didn't want to participate. And of course, I was suspended for, I can't remember how long it was for. But when I went home, my mom didn't even blink an eye. She was like, good job. But yeah, I sort of, had a kind of rebellious nature, I suppose, from when I was very young. Yeah.
But it also points to something about Zebra's family. You say they're autodidacts and atheists. And mm-hmm. there's one more A.
Yeah, anarchists.
That even if they hadn't been forced into exile, there's a way in which they're sort of in exile, even Absolutely. When they're connected to their own land and culture.
Absolutely. And I think Zebra's journey is in part understanding the faults in that, right? That her father, it's a cruel kind of love. I mean, they're so close, but she's just so isolated from others. And I think it's the relationship with the philologist, right, Ludo Bembo, that eventually forces her to look at that. And it's a kind of painful reflection, but it's the only way that she does actually change somewhat through the course of the novel.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to the writer Azarine van der Vliet Alumi about her latest book, Call Me Zebra. So the writer Enrique Villamatas, he coined the phrase literature sickness, something that in your book, Zebra suffers great bouts of. And you wrote this really interesting piece about it for The Believer. And you're looking primarily at Henry James' Portrait of a Lady and Lynn Tillman's Motion Sickness. And in it, you describe literature sickness as a feverish obsession with reading and with viewing the world through the lens of literature. And we definitely see this with our protagonist, the way that literature is informing her choices in the book and how she's trying to live out her family's commandments of literature is your sword and seek refuge in literature. With writers like Walter Benjamin or Dante, which feel as flesh and blood and as vital to her in the book, to me, as her own family, like even maybe more present in some regards than her own family. And she even consults books in an oracular fashion, opening up books to get wisdom. You have this great quote from that Believer essay that I'd love for you to elaborate on, but in relationship to Zebra. So you say, while the compulsion to read threatens to erode the reader's sense of reality, it also uncovers some hidden truth about the nature of the self in light of the very reality it is required to operate. In other words, it erodes one in order to unveil the other. Can you speak to that a little?
So for me, the great book of literature sickness, and I think probably for Enrique Villamatas as well, is Don Quixote, where you have this very picaresque, kind of funny, hysterical narrator who so deeply is invested in literature that he believes he can reinvent himself as a literary figure and go on these kinds of journeys through Spain, and because it's really an exploration of the difference between like perception or reality, right? The mind encountering the world, and oftentimes there's an incongruity there that can be really tragic or really funny or both. And I just love that character of Don Quixote and the ways in which he makes me laugh out loud when I'm reading his sort of his monologues, and the way that he can convince himself that something he's seeing is something a representation of something he's read in one of the chivalric tales that he's obsessed with. And I think that the Believer essay is sort of about exploring the ways in which realism itself is a kind of construct, right? It's not a one-to-one representation of reality. It's a kind of hyperbolic representation of space and psychology and the body. And in a book that's both exercising realism and at the same time about obsession with reading, the way that we see in Tillman's work or Henry James's work, what we're getting is a kind of mapping of consciousness through time onto the page. And so you're both getting the signposts of realism and being mesmerized or hypnotized into thinking that you're experiencing this perfectly constructed story world that's sort of mimicking our world. But there's so many layers of depth to it that the deeper you descend, it begins to erode at that idea that this is a stable representation, right? That it's static. And I think that's something both Tillman and Henry James do so beautifully, is just, it's a descent reading their work through literature, but also you eventually go through the sort of realism, right? The curtain of realism, you go through it and then you're looking at the backstage, right? At how it was constructed. And that in of itself makes you question what you're reading or think more deeply about this idea that realism is somehow representation or truth, or that there is a one-to-one relationship, like I was saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of complex ideas, but I think really simple at its core is that we can't really perceive a kind of solid static realism with a capital R. I mean, that's not how our minds work.
Well, I wonder if you're also going at, can we even achieve a solid static selfhood with a capital S? Because you talk about how Tillman's book reveals the unreality of self. And at another point, you say, at their core, books that explore what it means to inhabit life through literature are also examining the intersubjective nature of consciousness, probing the gap between perception and reality. And I wondered if these two things are inextricably linked, the unreality of self and in the intersubjective nature of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like when I think about this going into depth,
right,
then I think about deep time and the palimpsest when you're looking at Italy. Maybe that's also the same in our mind. Like the more you go through the layers, the more you see other people in your own mind, like Zebra's
Absolutely.
Seeing in herself.
Yeah. And I think that the sort of, well, it goes to the heart of individualism and what is individualism, right? If the self isn't static, which I don't think it is, right? It's kind of this like kaleidoscopic, moving, dynamic force. And it's deeply interconnected to other people, to space, to history, everything that we've inherited, right? Even through our genetic coding. There's no such thing as a kind of self that exists separate from others or separate from the environment. And that is such a comforting notion for me that... I don't know, it's almost sort of has some sort of Buddhist resonances, right? That where there is just one fabric, and if you move something on one end, everything else is going to shift to adjust to it or to react to it in some ways. And to come back to Zebra, what she's trying to do is to access this space. But of course, it's so difficult to access, and often we only access that kind of deep peace just momentarily, and then we're back in the kind of chaos and the sort of veneer of reality. But she is trying to account for life as a kind of totality that includes both the possibility of our death, our actual death, and our lives, and the ways in which there are parts of us that die when we lose people or we're displaced. And she talks about Blanchot a lot and his idea that the totality is unreal, right? So if you look at the self or you look at totality, there is a kind of unreality to it because you can't measure it. You can't contain it. It's so much vaster and bigger and more movable than we're often comfortable with.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but I thought about Zebra's selfhood and the moving from the so-called new world to the so-called old world, which some people might think of as facing backwards.
Mm.
It reminded me of something that Forrest Gander has said in a description of the language and gestures of the Bolivian people, the Aymara.
Mm.
They're the only known people where spatially the future is behind them. Because you can't see it. You can't see
the
future. And so the past is in front of them. And when they gesture about something that's happened in the past, when they're accessing memory, they gesture forward. And when I think of Zebra and the Aymara, it makes me think that it isn't a coincidence that the other books of literature sickness that you examined also involve people moving from the new world to the old world.
Yeah.
So we have this... I wondered about looking back, or as the Aymara would say, looking forward into the past.
Yeah, I love that. It's so interesting. I mean, Zebra talks about the future as being history, right? Or that history is the future. And she talks about, she's really interested in precognition and has these kinds of Like you said, she consults these texts, these older medieval or even before then, these texts as oracles of wisdom to see what's coming, right? And news of the future for her is embedded in the past and for her father as well. And I think that it's really interesting to think about Henry James or Lynn Tillman in relation to passports. James in particular, who sort of acquired his British citizenship not long before he passed away. But then I also think about the reverse, Nabokov and his relationship to his documents of immigration and his passports. And this kind of, on the one hand for Nabokov, accumulation of new selves that he has to perform, right? Mm-hmm. Because they exist, they've been, this self has been documented in a new passport, and now he has to invent that self in order to perform it. Versus in Henry James, he's almost like shedding the passports and arriving at this sort of what to him feels like some authentic self, which of course I question that word, but right. Yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing to think about.
Well, I mean, the first, you mentioned Don Quixote is the quintessential book of literature sickness. And it was the first book I thought of with this, with Zebra, and partially because she's creating reality as she moves through the world through the reality she's constructing in her right. mind and in relationship to other books. And I want to talk more about Don Quixote, but I was wondering if maybe you could also point us to any other examples that mm-hmm. you particularly like in the lit sick genre.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think of Dante's The Divine Comedy as being completely about literature sickness, whether it's his relationship to theological texts or to Virgil, right? I mean, Virgil guides him through hell and I think purgatory as well. And that's a book to me that's deeply about literature sickness. Let me think off the top of my head. Enrique Villamata is the one that I love the most. It's called Montano's Malady, and it's a great translation out with New Directions. And then there is Valeria Luiselli's The Story of My Teeth, mm-hmm. which also references a lot of Petrarch and other kinds of books. And Petrarch himself is another good example of someone who's engaged with these other texts. And then there's a tradition of doing that in Japanese literature with Basho. And it's his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which includes these walking pilgrimages to sites that other poets had traveled to, and he records their poems and meditates on them and then composes his own poems in response. So there's a lot of...
So Zebra would have liked that book.
Yeah, yeah. I've read that book quite a number of times, and I just... It's very slow and meditative, but I absolutely love it, yeah.
So if we were to move on to Don Quixote in relationship mm-hmm. to this book, the place where I feel like there's the deepest resonances in the way you portray the romantic relationship between Zebra and yeah. the philologist, the Italian philologist, Ludo Bembo, her on-again, off-again love affair with him. So that's sort of the source of both the book's tension mm-hmm. and also a lot of its humor.
Yeah.
And it's also the place where we most experience the limitations of Zebra's own self-narrative. It's the place where we can see around the way she presents the world to us. So mm-hmm. we start to see like, oh, this world seems like it's hermetic and perfected, and yet there's some, it's also producing some difficulties for her, particularly in the romantic world. But it made me think of the similar relationship between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Yeah. With Quixote, he has the fever, sort of the feverish imaginative life. He's even tall and skinny and not really, he's more otherworldly in a mm-hmm. bodily sense. And Panza is motivated by the appetites of the world. And here we have Zebra as almost a disembodied character. She hardly eats. She's ruminating all the time. She's tormented by her exile, her absence of home, and like her ancestors, finds her home in the world of words. But in an ironic way, even though she finds a home in the world of words, she's exiled from her body. Mm-hmm. So in a way, she's kind of living off of the words as her food. I was ready to devour the next sentence, to eat Benjamin quoting Hegel, to consume an infinite.